Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schenneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you want to download it or put it on an iPhone, iPad, you know, download it off iTunes, however you want to do it. Today we have an excellent show as we wade into the Fourth Amendment and e-discovery. Back in 1991, I was a dual degree student who had completed my MBA and was sitting in a required constitutional law course, and to say I was less than passionate would be an understatement. Yet today, as I follow e-discovery across the evidence spectrum, you begin to see some very interesting issues when criminal law encounters ESI. And that's where the Fourth Amendment enters the picture. So for that, for this topic, I'm in complete reliance on my panelists, Justin Murphy, who educated me on the issues presented by the Fourth Amendment, which is being looked at as a backdrop against tools which were never imagined by the drafters of the Constitution. You know, think of it. Back when they drafted the Constitution, they had no iPads, PCs, cell phones, and the fastest way from D.C. to New York was by horse. So we've come a long way, and Justin, who's doing the show with me today, is of counsel at Crowell & Moring's Washington, D.C. office, where he practices in the White Collar and Regulatory Enforcement Group and eDiscovery and Information Management Group. Justin's practice focuses on SEC enforcement, white-collar criminal matters, eDiscovery matters relating to internal and government investigations, and related civil litigation. He's represented and counseled corporate and individual clients in all phases of securities, white-collar crime, criminal and civil investigations, and proceedings involving the SEC, FINRA, Department of Justice, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, CFTC, and other agencies. Justin also advises clients on e-discovery issues. His practice includes litigation readiness, planning, legal holds, and electronic discovery processes. Justin routinely counsels clients on electronic discovery issues in the context of internal and government investigations, including the use of computer forensics as an investigative tool, and has extensive experience in negotiating with government investigators concerning the preservation, processing, and production of electronically stored information, ESI. And I should add as a footnote, we're going to be addressing that topic in a podcast that Justin's joining us on in a couple of weeks on government investigations. So, but Justin also has extensive experience advising clients on the federal rules of civil procedure related to electronically stored information, records, and information management technology issues, cost considerations, and related ethical issues. He's been published a number of times on e-discovery and criminal cases in a variety of publications, such as BNA, the ABA National Institute on White Collar Crime, Digital Discovery and E-Evidence, as well as in the Sedona Conference Institute. Justin, thanks for joining us on this show.
Thank you.
Before we start, I always like to ask the first-time panelists how they became interested in electronic discovery. So how did you become interested in electronic discovery?
One of the focuses of my practice is on e-discovery in the criminal sphere. In my work in representing companies and individuals in government investigations and other criminal matters, I've had the opportunity to be involved in and really sink my teeth into a lot of challenging and interesting e-discovery-related issues, really at the outset of what's now a burgeoning field. So although the primary focus on e-discovery has been related to civil matters up till now, we're now really beginning to see e-discovery issues coming to the criminal side, and I've really enjoyed being involved in such a rapidly expanding field.
Yeah, so let's jump into this. For the corporate types like me, who I think I'm beyond a statute of limitations, I literally slept through constitutional law when I showed up. Did pass the course, though, as I recall. It was a last-ditch effort right at the end to realize I needed to pass. But help us to recall the Fourth Amendment. I recall something about unreasonable searches and seizures from criminal law. You want to add to that?
Sure. The Fourth Amendment provides for the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures, and that no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the and the persons or things to be seized. So a search of a building premise or a residence or a computer will need to meet the requirements of the second clause of the Fourth Amendment, the so-called warrants clause. So such a search, which is often a document search, will need to be supported by probable cause, and it must describe the items to be seized with sufficient particularity so that the officer exercising the search can identify with reasonable certainty the items that are specified. I want to highlight one exception. That's the plain view doctrine, which is going to play a key role in what we're going to be discussing today.
Okay.
Under the plain view doctrine, if an officer in the proper course of executing a warrant comes across a matter in plain view and has probable cause to believe the matter constitutes evidence of a crime, the officer can then seize that matter even though it's not among the items specified in the warrant. So you think of it as requiring three items. The initial intrusion is constitutional. The items themselves are in plain view, and their incriminating nature is immediately apparent.
Now, how do personal computers get impacted by the Fourth Amendment when the government's looking for evidence?
I think it's worth noting at the outset that there are not a lot of e-discovery decisions in the criminal world. But with regard to the Fourth Amendment and search warrants in particular, this is one of the few areas where there are a fair number of decisions and Circuit Court of Appeal decisions, which is fairly uncommon in the e-discovery world, whether you're talking civil or criminal. And at the heart of these controversies is the collision between the Fourth Amendment's particularity requirement for search warrants and the plain view doctrine, and the search and seizure of computers where every file could potentially contain the particular evidence that's identified in the warrant. With computers, you're talking about volumes of data and documents, you alluded to this earlier, that were not contemplated in the 18th century when the Fourth Amendment was drafted. With computer warrants, you need to think of it as two searches and seizures. So first is the search of the place that's specified in the warrant, and the seizure of that information because the practical realities of on-site searches, because of the volume of data that can be on computers, because of the fact that computer files can be readily disguised, and of course that the information you're looking for is likely intermingled with personal or other irrelevant data, so it's too hard to filter on-site. So the need to overseas in that first search and seizure is a reality. The second search and seizure is then at the law enforcement offices where you're searching and seizing data from the warehouse of data on the computer that you had previously seized. The debate here arises from that second search and seizure. When you've overseas, you've created a risk that every ESI warrant will be a general warrant, which allows the government to romp freely through data in plain view, whether the investigators have probable cause to do so or not. And that would render the Fourth Amendment meaningless. So the debate can also be characterized as the role of the judiciary. How much should the government be controlled for that second search and seizure? And importantly, for search warrants, are computers or do computers deserve special treatment? Or are they simply analogous to a document container like a filing cabinet?
Well, let's talk about some of the cases here. So how has the Fourth Amendment been brought into the e-discovery circles? And I guess Balco would be a good place to start.
It's worth providing a factual background to the comprehensive drug testing case, CDT, which is also known as the Balco decision. Back in 2004, government agents executed search warrants at an independent medical testing lab seeking information about 10 baseball players who had allegedly obtained steroids from Balco. During that search, the government made duplicate copies of the lab's computer directories, which included drug testing data for more than 100 other baseball players, as well as athletes in other sports. On the basis of the information in those directories, the government obtained additional search warrants relating to the approximately 100 other baseball players who were listed in the database as having tested positive for steroids. There were actually several court proceedings, but simply put, each of the district courts involved found a violation of the Fourth Amendment, but a panel of the Ninth Circuit disagreed, ruling in favor of the government. Then in August of 2009, an en banc panel of the Ninth Circuit reversed the original panel ruling and issued new and enhanced guidelines for ESI warrants. The court really took on the ESI search conundrum head on, stating in the opening paragraph of its opinion that the case was about the, quote, procedures and safeguards in the federal courts that federal courts must observe in issuing and administering search warrants and subpoenas for electronically stored information. A few things worth noting about the opinion. The court rejected the government's argument that data beyond the 10 baseball players was in plain view, such an approach the court held would, and this is a direct quote, would make a mockery of the procedures designed to maintain the privacy of materials that are intermingled with seizable materials and to avoid turning a limited search for particular information into a general search of office file systems and computer databases. Interestingly, the court did acknowledge that the practical realities make traditional on-site searches of ESI impractical because it's readily disguised, it's easily manipulated, it's voluminous and almost always intermingled with irrelevant data. And effective searches can often only be accomplished safely and effectively in a controlled environment. So the court did acknowledge that the need to overseas is a reality. But as given that, the court determined that greater vigilance on the part of judicial officers is required due to the reality that overseasing is an inherent part of the electronic search process. So in an attempt to ensure such vigilance, the court established some explicit requirements. This is the really interesting part of the decision. It issued five requirements, which I'll move through. I'll summarize briefly. That magistrates should insist that the government waive reliance on the plain view doctrine in digital evidence cases. That privileged review teams or taint teams should be used. That the warrants themselves have to disclose the actual risks of the destruction of information, as well as any prior efforts to seize information in other judicial proceedings. That the government search protocol has to be designed to uncover only the information for which it has probable cause, and then only that information can be examined by the case agents. And then finally, at the end of the day, the government must destroy or return the non-responsive data, keeping the issuing magistrate informed about when it has done so and what it has kept. So needless to say, in the Ninth Circuit, the requirements for government searches of ESI have been enhanced, and those requirements have some teeth. So although it accepts the reality, the notion of overseizing, it at least adopts some very clear and enforceable procedures to prevent the worst government abuses. The controversial part of CDT is the specific guidance. That is unusual, but the underlying thinking really isn't. If you don't have some sort of control or filter team approach, you're going to end up with the exact type of general warrant that the Fourth Amendment prohibits. And if you think about it, it's a pretty chilling scenario. If the Fourth Amendment doesn't prevent looking through everything on a certain computer, such as, for example, intermingled data from people in other sports who are not even identified in the warrant, then it doesn't prevent anything at all.
Yeah, I just did a podcast last week on PCs and in e-discovery on the civil side, and our conclusion there was this is generally not a good thing on the civil side. I guess on the criminal side, it can be even worse. for those reasons, I mean, the intermingling of data, who's actually using the computer, those types of things.
Absolutely.
So anyway, after Balco, two other courts have looked at search warrants in cases where super athletes aren't involved who aren't baseball players or Olympians. And these other cases involve less than sympathetic people. I guess the Williams case we talked about was a child porn case, and there was a Voyer case, which also involved some child porn, the Mann case. So why don't you talk about these cases generally and the split in authority we have right now from Balco?
Sure. Well, as you just noted, there are two recent decisions who have disagreed with the CDT decision. It's the Fourth and Seventh Circuit. Both were issued in January of 2010. Now, the upshot of these is that personal and work data intermingled on systems can be seized by the government, not because there's probable cause to believe it's related to a crime, but simply because the information happens to share space on a computer system with other information that's specified in the warrant. Let's take the Williams case first out of the Fourth Circuit. In the Williams case, it was held that the officer's seizure of images on a DVD portraying child pornography was justified by the plain view exception to the warrant requirement. In that case, the officers had a warrant to search the defendant's computers and other digital media for evidence relating to the crimes of making threats and computer harassment. And in their search, they discovered numerous images of child pornography. The Fourth Circuit found that the warrant in that case impliedly authorized officers to open each file on the computer to view its contents, at least on a cursory basis, to determine whether that file fell within the scope of the warrant's authorization, i.e., whether or not it was related to the designated crimes in the warrant. The court went on to to say that to be effective, the search can't be limited to reviewing only the file designation or the labeling, as they can easily be manipulated to hide their substance. So once the court had accepted that the computer search must, by implication, authorize at least a cursory review of each file on the computer, then the plain view criteria was readily met. One has to wonder if there's anything left of the Fourth Amendment if officers can go in and rummage around a computer like this. The Mann decision out of the Seventh Circuit, in that case, the defendant was under investigation for the crime of voyeurism when he was caught installing a video camera in the women's locker room at a Red Cross facility where he was a lifeguard. In connection with that investigation, prosecutors obtained a search warrant to search Mr. Mann's residence for digital images of women in locker rooms or other private areas. And in executing the warrant, the officers seized various computers and other media, and they subsequently found evidence of child pornography on these items. The Seventh Circuit upheld the search and specifically addressed the CDT decision, which, interestingly, the Williams case chose not to even acknowledge. The Mann court wrote that, although the Ninth Circuit rules provide some guidance in a murky area, we are inclined to find more common ground with the dissent's position that jettisoning the plain view doctrine entirely in digital evidence cases is an efficient but overbroad approach. Instead, the court counseled that a more considered approach would be to permit the case law surrounding the application of the plain view doctrine to computer searches to develop incrementally through the normal course of fact-based adjudication. The court then went on to counsel law enforcement officers to ensure that warrants particularly and narrowly describe the things to be searched and seized.
It sounds like we're ready for a Supreme Court case in this area with the split. There was a recent case that people were looking to for some guidance on e-discovery and technology, the Kwan case. Does Kwan help us to understand what the Supreme Court thinks about technology and the Fourth Amendment? Kwan, of course, dealt with cell phones being used at work by a police officer with a company policy against personal use of the cell phone running in the conflicting treatment by the police officer's supervisor who let the police officers use the cell phones for personal use as long as they paid for the excess costs, which Kwan, of course, did, and actually said that the usage wouldn't be monitored. Then when doing an audit of whether this policy was working, and if personal texts were in fact being paid for by individuals, some of Kwan's very personal texts were encountered, causing him to sue the police department. Of course, this isn't a criminal matter, but it did involve the Fourth Amendment. So I guess to revisit the beginning of the question, can we learn anything from the Kwan case on search and seizure in criminal cases?
Well, first, as you know, Kwan was not a criminal matter, and it did not address the warrant clause of the Fourth Amendment. But I do think the court telegraphed a bit its potential reluctance to delve too deeply into resolving privacy expectations involving ESI as technology continues to evolve. In the Kwan decision, the Supreme Court first addressed whether Kwan had a reasonable expectation of privacy regarding his text messages and determined that it didn't need to resolve that issue to reach the result in the case, i.e., the court assumed that Kwan had at least a limited expectation of privacy, and then the court went on to explain that it must, quote-unquote, proceed with care in resolving issues of privacy expectations with respect to electronic communications. This is a quote about that. Quote, the judiciary risks error by elaborating too fully on the Fourth Amendment implications of emerging technology before its role in society has become clear. Rapid changes in the dynamics of communications and information transmission are evident, not just in the technology itself, but in what society accepts as proper behavior. It is uncertain how workplace norms and the law's treatment of them will evolve. Close quote. So, although the court made clear that its holding was limited to the reasonableness inquiry under the Fourth Amendment, I think this case may be relied on more for its commentary regarding employees' expectation of privacy in workplace electronic communications. Having said that, the Fourth Amendment is from the 18th century. It's 100 years before the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk. I can't even guess what computers will be like 10 to 20 years from now. This will be a developing area for some time, and it's hard to predict where it will go. And I think the Supreme Court seemed to recognize that in the Kwan decision.
Well, I guess one thing we know is that the Supreme Court is not that tech savvy, but they are very reluctant to create a black letter rule in this area. What does this mean to the split that we just talked about earlier when search warrants are at issue? Do you think the Supreme Court can punt on a search warrant case?
Well, we're certainly primed for Supreme Court review, and I hope they don't punt. This is the debate, whether computers deserve special treatment for warrants or simply analogous to document containers like a filing cabinet. We have circuit courts of appeals at opposite ends of a broad spectrum now, and the government and others on the wrong end of search warrants need some consistent guidance, I think. The Ninth Circuit says, yes, computers are special and do deserve special treatments with regard to search warrants. And the Fourth Circuit and the Seventh Circuit say no, they don't deserve any special treatment. So why should ESI warrants be any different from plain view in a filing cabinet? It comes down to the problem of intermingled data and the volume of data. You know, how many filing cabinets are we talking about? Are we talking about 1, 50, 100, 100,000, 1 million, 100 million? Because of the size that we're dealing with, the size and the volume of data, we're no longer describing the place to be searched with particularity. The computer itself needs to be described virtually. As another way to give an example, if you have a warrant to search a specific apartment in an apartment building, should you also get to search every other apartment in the building just because it's in the same building? We'll see what the Supreme Court says about that.
Well, you're in Washington, D.C., and you speak quite a bit, Justin, so, you know, there's a chance that you might be on the Supreme Court in 5 years, okay? So if this issue is still out there, what would you do if you were on the Supreme Court? How would you come down on this?
I think the right place is somewhere in between the Mann decision and CDT. CDT's requirements may be too inflexible to realistically impose. I come back to the double search and seizure that I described earlier. For that second search and seizure, you should need a magistrate judge involvement. The concept that the government can't just open up anything without judicial supervision, and that magistrates do have the authority to require such protocols or other controls, I think is a reasonable and practical solution. Before that second search and seizure, you need a step, or you need something that provides controls before the government cracks open the intermingled data. The government should have to go back to court and say, here's what we have, and here's what we're going to do. The magistrate judge needs this guidance because this is an ex parte process. The defense counsel isn't there at this stage in the game. The magistrate is only hearing the government's point of view, and the magistrate needs to test that point of view. There should be a pause in between the first search and then describing with particularity the place in the computer that will be searched in that second search.
Okay. Well, Justin, thank you for joining us on the show. I look forward to doing this upcoming show I mentioned earlier on government investigations in a week or so. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our show. That's Easy Bytes of ESI information, which is how you could remember it phonetically. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.